On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He was watched by millions, respected by millions. He had a voice like no other, recognizable in an instant. CBS newsman Mike Wallace spent nearly 40 years just with 60 Minutes. He died yesterday at 93. In November 2005, we sat down with Wallace in our studio, talked about life, the art of journalism, and slowing down, which did not come naturally for the man known for his fiercely confrontational style, as in this clip from 1982 with General William Westmoreland, commander of U.S. forces in Vietnam, on one of his military strategies during the Vietnam War.
Isn't it a possibility that the real reason for suddenly deciding in the summer of 1967 to remove an entire category of the enemy from the order of battle was based on political considerations?
No, decidedly not.
Didn't you make this clear in your August 20th cable?
No, I
have a copy of your August 20th cable.
Sure, okay.
Back in 2005, we talked about Mike Wallace's memoir, Between You and Me. We heard about his astonishing interviews with Anwar Sadat and Arthur Miller, Malcolm X and Ronald Reagan. Today, we bring you that conversation. This hour, On Point, our last interview with Mike Wallace. Mike Wallace, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you. First question to you, though, Tom.
Oh, boy.
Raised on an Illinois farm and attended Yale University, what was a farmer doing in New Haven going to Yale?
Hey, it's America. Everybody looks up, out, and around. You did the same thing, and I won't let you turn the tables on me, Mr. Interviewer.
And worked as a supervisor and dynamiter in Alaska's oil fields?
Surveyor.
So, oh, that's right.
I've got to get a bit in your teeth, Mike Wallace, or you'll take this away. I know you're the interviewer,
but
we've got to turn the tables on you.
All right.
You grew up just, a matter of blocks from this studio
that's
in Brookline,
correct.
Massachusetts. You became the most tenacious interviewer at that level on television, I would say, at that tip-top level, with a reputation that you were even called Mike Malice when you first came out. People saw it as so ferocious. Were you like this from the get-go? Where did you get this get-your-teeth-in and don't-give-up character?
You know something, really, Tom? First of all, I just wanted to be a radio announcer. That's all I thought about. And then, spending some time in the Navy in the Second World War, mm-hmm. I figured, hey, I don't want to just read commercials and rip and read news and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't have the demeanor I don't have the face or the demeanor for as an anchor. So let's see what kind of a job can I carve out of a reporter's job. I was a nosy kid here in Brookline mm-hmm. back then.
Went to Edward Devotion School, same school JFK went to.
Jack only went there for about 3 years.
Yeah,
but incidentally, please ask me about Robert Kraft, the guy who owns
the New England Patriots.
That's exactly right.
What shall I ask you? What shall we ask you about Robert Kraft?
Well, he says that he went to Edward Devotion School.
Yes.
And Jack Kennedy went to, and Myron Wallace, which was
as in Mike.
Yeah. And that he had he told me that there were pictures of the three of us, three famous graduates of
JFK, Robert Kraft, and Myron Mike Wallace.
That is correct.
On the wall at Edward Devotion School.
So I went back to the Edward Devotion School yesterday for the first time in, a quarter century or more.
What a journey.
And there are no pictures of no one any place. It was all...
What, he's bluffing you?
I have no idea why he bothered.
He's making a fake call from the sidelines.
That
he's got Mike
exactly
Wallace
right.
Going.
I haven't talked to him about it yet. I mean, come on. Why does he...
We're going to hear a lot of clips from tremendous interviews you've done over the years in this hour, but I want to go back a little bit to that childhood, just so near this studio in Brookline, Edward Devotion School. Sounds like a Catholic school, but as you point out, it's not. Edward Devotion was...
Edward Devotion was... I found out some more. I was always under the impression that Edward Devotion was riding his horse at the same time that Paul Revere was riding his horse.
Yeah.
Well, it turned out that Edward Devotion, I learned this yesterday, it was William Dawes who was riding his horse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Edward Devotion had died in 1765 before any of this took place.
All these years they had the wool pulled over Mike Wallace's eyes on whether he rode with Paul Revere or not.
That's correct.
But take us to that. Your parents were immigrants?
Immigrants from Russia.
Jewish immigrants from the shtetl, as you write in the book. Did they raise tough kids? Did they raise kids? I mean, you were a violinist, I think, in high school. But were you aggressive? Were you in the face of the teachers, of your principal, of your colleagues, the same way?
Not especially. No, I worked with a guy by the name of Ted Yates.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Yates, to whose widow I am now married and have been for about the last 20, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
He was a wonderful producer, reporter, etc., etc. He died on the first day of the Six-Day War because he was, by that time, he was a correspondent for NBC as well as a producer and a brave, brave man. In any case, Ted, we did the first half-hour news show in New York City.
This is way before 60 Minutes, 1956, a show called Night Beat.
You're right. The first half-hour was news, and then the second half-hour and beyond was an interview show, and that's the first time that I began to understand that there is... I love to do research and write the questions down, and when I'm talking to somebody and the interviewee, the object of my presumed scrutiny, suddenly realizes that I, as an interviewer, have done a lot of work.
You're on to them.
Exactly right. And our eyes meet, and that chemistry of confidentiality develops, and we become, in a sense, co-conspirators. I mean, you and I are looking at each other through our glasses
right now. Yeah.
And I'm beginning to know who you are.
And it's
if you
a
know
kind
me.
Of tractor beam that you get on them.
That's exactly
once
right.
They know that you've got the details. I want to begin, throughout this hour, I really want to hear you at work over the years, if we may. I want to begin to tiptoe back into some of these. This is not a particularly confrontational interview, but a very significant and interesting one. I want to go to you speaking with Martin Luther King, Jr., 1966. This is a time when there was a growing call for violence in the civil rights cause, which he rejected wholly. Let's listen.
I will never change in my basic idea that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to the Negro in his struggle for freedom and justice. I think for the Negro to turn to violence would be both impractical and immoral.
There is an increasingly vocal minority who disagreed totally with your tactics, Dr. King.
There's no doubt about that. I will agree that there is a group in the Negro community advocating violence now. The vast majority of Negroes still feel that the best way to deal with the dilemma that we face in this country is through nonviolent resistance.
Martin Luther King speaking with interviewer Mike Wallace there.
Martin Luther King out of BU.
Out of BU, no less, of course. That's right, Boston University.
Yeah.
You've stayed curious and you've stayed tough, but you do have at least one hero, and you say it's Martin Luther King, Jr. Many people might name him, but why do you in particular, Mike Wallace?
Well, I name him the man, the indispensable man, and the man I most admire because he was dead honest. We had a lot of talk recently about Rosa Parks,
yes,
a brave, wonderful woman,
but
it was Martin Luther King, truly, who made sure that bus boycott that started after she moved her chair, not to the back of the bus, but she was going to. It was he, and this was his first parish, first job. In any case, Lyndon Johnson, as a Southern politician, astonished me because what he did was he tried to bring the races together.
As a Southerner.
That's exactly right. And so Martin Luther King, as a result, of course, was grateful.
But still not afraid to criticize Johnson on the war.
That's the point. He took on, in effect, his patron, and he said, it's the wrong war, wrong time, wrong place, Vietnam. And can you imagine taking on the guy who did so much to bring the races together in this country?
I can imagine, we know that he did that. I can also imagine Mike Wallace taking on, well, perhaps not a patron, but a power. Martin Luther King Jr., your hero, was a crusader, a campaigner for social justice. Do you see Mike Wallace in the same mold? Has Mike Wallace been a crusader for something?
No, I'm not a crusader for anything except, if you will, for truth. Out of the mouths of reporters and in newspapers and in, you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Truth, accuracy, fairness, but as far as a
social agenda?
No, none.
We're re-airing this hour our last interview with newsman Mike Wallace. He joined me in the studio back in 2005. He died yesterday at 93 in the New Canaan, Connecticut care facility where he lived in the last few years of his life. Mike Wallace, it's often been said, didn't just interview people, he interrogated them. The world noticed and applauded. He won 21 Emmys for his work, the last just a handful of years ago when he was 89. His career began long before 60 Minutes, but his 60 Minutes became his biggest showcase, and Mike Wallace was a huge factor in the success and impact of that show. When we come back, he talks about Anwar Sadat, Malcolm X, President George W. Bush, and much more. You can share your memories of Mike Wallace on Facebook at On Point Radio and at our website, onpointradio.org. After the break, we'll hear more of my 2005 interview with CBS newsman Mike Wallace. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and we're listening back this hour to my 2005 interview with CBS newsman Mike Wallace, the gotcha guy, as some called him. He spent 40 years on the air with 60 Minutes, week after week in millions of homes. On Sunday, he died at 93. In 2005, we talked with Mike Wallace about his memoir, written with Gary Paul Gates, Between You and Me, and his years of tough investigative journalism and conversations with public figures of all kinds. His book came with a DVD of some terrific interviews. Here's a bit from 1957, Mike Wallace talking with Margaret Sanger, pioneer in the birth control movement. In this interview, on a day where abortion was being discussed before the Supreme Court, she went at the Catholic Church on birth control. Let's listen.
According to the tenets of Catholicism, they rule that birth control violates not only the church's position, but they say that it violates a natural law. Therefore, birth control is a sin, no matter who practices it.
I think it's untrue, and I think it's unnatural.
Well, let me ask you...
I think bears it out that it's an unnatural attitude to take, and how do they know? I mean, after all, they're celibates. They don't know love. They don't know marriage. They know nothing about bringing up children or any of the marriage problems of life. And yet they speak to people as if they were God.
Birth control movement leader Margaret Sanger with Mike Wallace in 1957. Mike, you know, in that clip, Margaret Sanger sounds like from a different era. Her voice, her cadence. You don't. What's the difference?
She was an angry woman. I mean, she was an... This is 1958.
Yes, okay.
And taking on the Catholic Church... She said, look, if you go to bed with somebody, you don't have to be having a child with that somebody. Mm-hmm. You're doing it mm-hmm. for reasons of love. Mm-hmm. She didn't mention lust, but
mm-hmm. It's life.
Exactly. And this was unheard of, somebody, particularly a woman talking that way at that time. And as you heard her cadence. Mm-hmm. She was
a little bit of that Eleanor Roosevelt sound to it.
Well,
higher strung right there.
Well, yes, a lot higher strung. Eleanor Roosevelt, whom I had interviewed back in 1957, Margaret Sanger came on the following year with me. And contraception, she is the mother of contraception. I didn't realize, for instance, in the state of Connecticut, it was against the law to use a contraceptive.
Even in your own bedroom with your own wife.
That's exactly right.
Or husband. Yes. Mike, tell us how, over the years, you've prepared for your interviews. You clearly come through. We heard it with General Westmoreland there. You had the evidence on your legal pad. You were ready to come right back at him. As you said, you had your questions ready to go. What's your process?
The same as yours, I guess, because I'm looking at you across this desk, Tom. Right. And you have all kinds of papers with questions, obviously, that you have written or...
Yes. Right here.
That's correct. And I'm waiting for the one that really embarrasses me.
I must be obligated. It's Mike Wallace, after all. Okay, we'll see what we can do.
Okay. That's what I do. If I'm going one-on-one like we are doing now,
yeah,
with somebody that I really care about and I don't have powers of subpoena, mm-hmm, then I've got to somehow get them to help me do it. And so I'll read everything and write down maybe 50, 75 questions.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I get on the air with, oh, not on the air necessarily, because it used to be live, but it's
but
not.
But before the camera, anyway.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly the person that I'm talking to figures, hey, he's done homework. He knows a lot about me. Therefore, I'm going to help.
And along they come.
Exactly right.
Mm. Let's listen to a little bit of your 1978 interview with Anwar Sadat. Of course, he was the leader in Egypt. And it looks from the clip that you were sitting in Cairo with him, as I recall. It's a real Mike Wallace moment. Let's hear it.
When one reads, applying the Jewish principle of putting a price on everything, one says, aha, Anwar al-Sadat, he is anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish.
Anti-Semite, this is something that has been invented to blackmail anyone and to scare anyone. No. I myself am a Semite. How could I be anti-Semite? They are my cousins.
I'm a Semite, says Anwar Sadat. How could I be anti-Semitic?
He is one of the finest men I have ever met. He really was devoted to peace. Can you imagine for him to come to Jerusalem, to the Knesset, to begin to really make peace with the Israelis?
So he is a great peacemaker. And Mike Wallace, the first thing you ask him is, are you an anti-Semite?
Well, I... the Jewish... I was reading from something that he said.
Yeah, the reason for the question is clear. The reference is obvious, but there never seemed to be, you tell us, is there a governor? Is there a question you've ever thought of that you didn't ask?
No. Faye Emerson, you're much too young, Tom. She was the first lady of television for a long time, and she said the following. There is no such thing as an indiscreet question. And you know something? It's true. Questions are in the mind of the public. Why doesn't he ask that? Why doesn't he go after this or that or whatever? There is no such thing as an indiscreet question, said Faye, and she was absolutely right. After all, it's only a question. What's wrong with as long as there's some common sense behind it and something that the audience is curious about? It's only a question.
Whether it's religion, sex...
Yes.
Politics.
I'm going to go to I'm going to go to page. I hope it's the right one. Here it is.
A man tiptoeing through his own memoir.
That is correct.
You can do that when you're 87.
That's correct. Come on. Keep talking, and
sure,
I'll find the damn thing.
Sure, I'm happy to keep talking. But while you're looking for it, why don't we take a call? We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation,
good,
Mike.
Good.
Jane is calling from Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Oh, gentlemen, I am so thrilled to talk to both of you. I can't even begin to tell you.
Great. What's on your mind, Jane?
Well, I'm actually an anchor woman in Lansing, Michigan at the CBS affiliate, WLNS, TV6. And my first job interview, as a matter of fact, in television was at this station, but long before I got the job, I was in radio, like Mr. Wallace, and wanted to make that jump, the big leap into television. And I was told by the general manager here that I just didn't have what it took to make that transition from radio to TV.
Ouch.
Yeah, so I think basically I went home and cried for a week, and then I really got angry and said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do what I want. It's my life, after all. And through the years, I managed to make my way up and get into television.
It took you 30 years?
Through the years.
It took me 30 years. Oh. But the funny story of all this, and the reason I called, one of the reasons, is because I heard years later that Mr. Wallace was given that same advice by the same general manager at the same station where I work, and I thought, look, if that's the same advice that he gave Mike Wallace, by God, I guess I'm not so bad after all.
And maybe so, you can make that transition, and you did, Jane.
And I did, and I've been here for 20 years now, which, you know, in medium-sized markets, that's pretty darn good.
That is pretty great.
Yeah, but you've always been an inspiration to me, Mr. Wallace, and obviously we carry, 60 Minutes here on our CBS affiliate, but I've always enjoyed your conversations and your interviews, and I never really thought that you were the pit bull, as maybe some might make you out to be. I thought you asked the honest questions that we were all saying, please ask.
That's music to my ears. That should be, for any reporter, for any interviewer, what does the audience really want to know about this guy or this woman who's being talked to on the air? And you know, I started at WOD in Grand Rapids.
Mm-hmm. $20 a week.
Correct.
Ah, boy. Jane, thanks for the love letter to Mike Wallace there. And Mike, it sounds like you've been an inspiration for someone else to make that jump from radio to television. I want to keep the sound of Mike Wallace at his work in our ear as well. I want to go back to an interview you did with Malcolm X, 1964. He dropped a bombshell in this interview when he attacked Muslim leader Elijah Muhammad.
Do you feel, perhaps, that you should now take over the leadership of the black Muslims?
No, I have no desire to take over the leadership of the black Muslims, and I have never had that desire. But I do have this desire. I have a desire to see the Afro-American in this country get the human rights that are his due to make a complete human being.
Are you the least bit afraid of what might happen to you as a result of making these revelations?
Oh, yes. I probably am a dead man already.
And a few months later, it was only a few months later, that he was indeed a dead man. He was a dead man because there was jealousy in the nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
He was far and away the most popular person. He reached both black and white people. And
you later sat his daughter down with Louis Farrakhan,
who had, it appeared
from the quote you used, called for Malcolm X's death.
In effect.
And you had those two attempt to reconcile. That was one testy and difficult exchange. I'm not sure it worked. I'm not sure there was reconciliation there. What was your conclusion?
My feeling was, well, what she said was, as I remember, Atala Shabazz, she was 6 years old when in the Audubon Ballroom her father was shot down by two or three black Muslims. And it turned out, of course, that Louis Farrakhan, who wanted to be a big shot in the Nation of Islam at the time, had said things that almost gave people a license to go after Malcolm X, who, again, you were talking about another brave, brave man. It was here in Boston.
Mm.
It was here in Boston that he was in prison. He was a con man. He was a hustler. He dealt in drugs and so forth, and then he began to read the works and listen to the works of Elijah Muhammad, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
And off it went.
And off it went. And he eventually, at first he wouldn't talk to me, but I had a reporter, a black reporter, working with me by the name of Louis Lomax, and he said, you know something? Malcolm has said that he would like to perhaps sit down to breakfast with you.
Mm-hmm.
And we met up in Harlem, and we immediately hit it off. And when he did his autobiography, I was so pleased to hear him write. He did it with Alex Haley, that I was one of the few white reporters that he trusted. He has become much more of an important figure in civil rights since his death, since the time he was shot down.
Towering figure in that martyrdom, I guess you might say.
Exactly right.
Mike, let me ask you about the television business. Your time in it was a time when all the attention was focused really on the three big networks.
Mm-hmm.
And within those networks, on a stable of stars, you very high among them, who were the focus of the entire country.
Exactly.
That meant a lot of things. It meant tremendous fame. It meant fortune. This was not $20 a week at WOOD. and it put you in a position that, where you had power, you had clout that often would equal that of the very powerful people you were interviewing in some respect.
You're building me up more than I deserve to be built up.
Well, they met with you because you had the audience of such great size. You had leverage.
By the time 60 Minutes came along,
mm-hmm.
but it was the 6:30 News mm-hmm. that really had the power. Walter Cronkite, mm. Huntley Brinkley, mm. Howard K. Smith, Harry Reasoner when he took over. The country listened at 6:30 at night. That's not there anymore.
What does it mean for accountability in our government, in our halls of power today, when there is no leverage like that, when the news eye is diffuse, when you don't have quite the same giants who can stride in and demand the interview and put the tough questions?
Well, try to demand an interview with anybody in the White House today. Do you know something? I have interviewed every president in the United States, it seems, since Abe Lincoln. And Marlene Safer says every first lady since Martha Washington.
Yep.
Except George W. Bush. I've never even met the man. Why? Karl Rove said, you're not going to talk. When he was governor of Texas, and I was doing a story down there about tort reform, mm-hmm. one thing and another, mm-hmm. and judges that got caught up. They were elected judges down there in the mm-hmm. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And there was a conflict of interest, obviously, mm-hmm. from people who had contributed to their campaigns. Well,
tough questions. They didn't like it, and you don't get another bite of the apple.
That's exactly right. That's
if you could interview President Bush today, Mike Wallace,
mm-hmm.
I know you haven't written out your list of 60 or 70 questions, but what would you ask him?
First question. And I thought about it because I was watching him as I was coming over here to
mm-hmm,
talk to you.
The speech at Annapolis.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
What in the world, sir, Mr. President, prepared you, what in your background, prepared you to be the commander-in-chief of the supreme power in the world? Your military background? No. Your business background? No. Your travel? You were an incurious man for such a long time. I'm at a loss to understand. And you were, according to Bob Woodward in his book, Plan of Attack, you said when asked if you ever talked to your dad, George H.W. Mm-hmm. Bush, number 41, about what he might be, what you might do better or different. No, you said, according to Bob Woodward. No, I look to a higher father. Give me a break.
Ooh. The Mike Wallace opening line for President George W. Bush. The last line of your book is, so how about it, Mr. President? Isn't it time you gave this old man a break? If Karl Rove is listening, Mike, if that's the question, I don't think the White House door is open quite yet.
I think you're probably right.
That is tough.
Yeah.
And your follow-up question, Mr. Wallace?
Well, it depends upon what the man says to me about his background. So many people say he's such a likable guy.
Mm-hmm.
I pass.
We're listening back to my 2005 interview with CBS newsman and 60 Minutes anchor Mike Wallace. He died yesterday at 93. For decades, that ticking 60 Minutes stopwatch and the big, familiar voice of Mike Wallace were a Sunday ritual for millions of Americans. I spoke with Wallace about his emotional interview with Arthur Miller after the death of Marilyn Monroe, about the evolution of the news media and his own time as a correspondent during the Vietnam War. Wallace also talked about what he saw as the right balance of entertainment and information in broadcast journalism. When we come back, more of that 2005 conversation. You can share your own memories of Mike Wallace at Facebook on Facebook at On Point Radio and at our website at onpointradio.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. CBS newsman Mike Wallace died yesterday at 93. We're listening back to my last interview with him in 2005 about his memoir, Between You and Me. Before the show, we had dipped back into some of Wallace's big interviews. In 1987, Mike Wallace spoke with playwright Arthur Miller. He was talking three decades after his marriage to Marilyn Monroe about that relationship.
You knew that it was doomed.
I didn't know it was doomed, but I certainly felt it had a good chance to be.
You said to her, I keep trying to teach myself how to lose you, but I can't learn yet. And she says, why must you lose me?
Well, it just shows you the power of instinct over what's left of your brains at such moments when you're being drawn to someone and you sense that it may not work and you can't stop it anyway.
Those were tough years. Wonderful years and terrible years.
Sure. They were. Well, there was a lot of pain. Certainly for her, and certainly for me.
Why? What did it do to you?
Well, it's a defeat. It always is.
Mike Wallace interviewing the playwright Arthur Miller on his relationship with Marilyn Monroe. Mike, this is a different kind of interview that you did, not the political interview, not the gotcha with the con man, but the sort of searching human interview about relationships, love, the intimate stuff.
Arthur and I were friends. We went to the University of Michigan together. Mm-hmm. And his face was so sad as he began to talk about it, because he obviously adored this woman. And the power of instinct, and you know that you're in trouble, you know it's not, it didn't make sense, the marriage. And he understood that it didn't make sense. What could they give each other?
And that phrase, the power of instinct over what's left of your brain.
Exactly right.
Under the sunshine of Marilyn Monroe.
Yes.
My God.
But he had written a book called Time Bends. I believe that was the time when I had, which was a wonderful book. And this man was such a wise man, and I retain so much admiration for this guy.
Oh, yeah. The work that has spoken to so many Americans and people around the world for so many years.
Exactly.
I want to turn to our callers, if I may. Patrick is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Earlier in the conversation, you were speaking about the great power that Mike Wallace and other interviewers have as they sit across from the world rulers. Mm-hmm. And as I noticed over the last 40 years, journalism has gone through some significant phases. I note three phases. Journalism has gone from being a journalism of facts, where they were truly reporting the facts, and it took a real turn during the Vietnam War to from a journalism of facts to a journalism of an agenda, and that the media in America particularly took on an agenda. You know, the North Vietnamese did not win one major battle.
And do you see Mike Wallace as part of that transition, for good or ill, Patrick?
Oh, I see it for ill. The North Vietnamese did not defeat the American forces.
Let's not refight the whole war. But did you have a third piece in that migration, Patrick?
I did. But let me finish the second one real quickly. The media is what defeated the American forces.
And number three?
And number three, we've seen it here come out in the last 5 years, where that agenda journalism has taken on, or at least it's been revealed here in the last 5 years, that it's come into a stealth agenda, where you have your Pulitzer Prize-winning New York journalists who have totally fabricated stories, as it's been revealed.
Yeah.
And even now, Mike's co-worker, Dan Rather, has been a part of a scheme to fabricate a story against the President of the United States.
Patrick, I think we've got the gist of that, and I want to put it to Mike Wallace while we've got the time. Mike, what about it? A kind of evolution in journalism from just the facts, ma'am, to agenda, to what Patrick describes as stealth agenda.
Well, it's an interesting point of view that he's talking about. Look, when 58,000 young Americans are killed in Vietnam, it wasn't a question of an agenda on the part of the American people. Said, what in the world are we fighting for over there that is worth killing 58,000 American young men and women? It wasn't, in my estimation. It was, finally, the American people said, hey, listen, it doesn't make sense. And then when I interviewed General William Westmoreland much later about this, because I had learned that he had from some of his intelligence people, he had put a ceiling of 300,000 for enemy over there.
He effectively misrepresented the number of enemy combatants.
That's correct. The uncounted enemy, a Vietnam deception. It wasn't 60 minutes. It was an hour and a half on our CBS reports. And Sam Adams from the CIA had documents to prove, and eventually he was proved absolutely right, there were 600,000 out there. Why did Westy put the 300,000 ceiling on? Because he knew damn well that if the American people, who had been told there was a light at the end of the tunnel, that all of a sudden, double the number of enemy were out there, he knew that politically we were going to have to, the American people would want us out of there.
So you're saying this wasn't an agenda, this was going after the facts. This was the facts, indeed. Let me ask you about another critique, tangential maybe to Patrick's, that says, as good as Mike Wallace and 60 Minutes have been, they've taken the news, television news, from the just the facts, ma'am, perspective to, they helped push it into the world of entertainment. Because, my gosh, you are an entertaining interviewer. And do you ever worry that the entertainment factor of your ambush journalism, your gotcha, your hard-charging style, overshadowed some of the core journalistic mission?
Good question. And to answer it, the lure of the chase. What is a reporter after? Is he after heat or light? Obviously, he should be after light. He's trying to get at the facts. But if he uses a technique, as for instance, an ambush interview, which means that you're chasing somebody down the street.
Mr. So-and-so, what about?
Exactly, exactly. And it became quite apparent to Don Hewitt, who used to run 60 Minutes, and to me simultaneously, hey, we're becoming a caricature of ourselves. And so we stopped the ambush interviews. The fact of the matter is, there are enough questions to be asked. And if somebody doesn't want to talk to you, you don't have the powers of subpoena. So it's perfectly sensible, it seems to me, to confront when you have that opportunity, the object of your scrutiny, and say, hey, look, we're entitled. You're running a business, or you're running a part of the government. We have the right to ask you whether you are somehow breaking laws, using lousy ethics.
But you're conceding that at a certain point, you and Don Hewitt agreed that it had tipped too far to the entertainment side of that equation.
Quite right. And then people began to copy us, and that embarrassed us. They were after the heat. They were after the drama of saying, hey, I'm going to get this guy, and watch me as I try to get this guy.
What do you think will be the lasting legacy, the 60 Minutes contribution to television news, the light-seeking or the heat-seeking?
Well, I think the light-seeking, really, really, even today. I mean, come on, we've been on the air for 37 years, and I can say this because I'm doing very little for 60 Minutes anymore. In the book that somebody keeps somewhere, 60 Minutes has done, I believe, a wonderful job at telling the American people where we have been right and where we have been wrong. And I'm not talking about the press. I'm talking about American institutions.
The country. Ginny's calling from Boston. Hi, Ginny. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Piggybacking what you were just talking about, my question is, in the culture of CBS News and in light of the recent movie about Edward R. Murrow, did you have hurdles being truthful, asking probing questions where the top people in the company said, you can't do that, that's not entertainment, that doesn't sell TV?
The truly, no.
Tobacco?
Tobacco was a problem, and it led me almost to resign or to threaten to resign unless our piece about tobacco with
1995, Jeffrey Wigand.
My hero. I mean, this is a guy.
He said cigarettes were seen as nicotine delivery systems.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And he was the first insider. The first insider in the tobacco industry, who was a major scientist in the tobacco industry, said, hey, this is addictive, and then impact boosted, and he had the means to prove it.
And CBS hit the brakes on that report.
They did. At that time, Larry Tisch, who owned the controlling share of CBS, his family owned the Lorillard Tobacco Company. So you say to yourself,
It doesn't take much math skill to add that up.
That's exactly right. A lot of us were angry about that, and some of us were going to quit. And I said, no, let's not quit. Let's steal, STEEL.
Mm-hmm.
Let's steal this through. We're going to get that damn piece on the air sooner than later. And it took us not more than 2-3 months to finally put the piece on the air that we had originally wanted to put on the piece.
What about the tenacity, the vigor, the digging determination of the American press looking forward? Do you see it being sustained, or do you see dynamics in TV and elsewhere that are clamping down on it, damping that?
Let me look. You're sponsored, right?
Well, we have sponsors, but of course a lot of our funding comes straight from our listeners.
Well, I know that, but I noticed that there have been two or three breaks in this hour.
Yes, also underwriters, commercial underwriters, that's right.
Do you owe them anything for that? Why do they sponsor you?
I assume they want the association with the listeners and the programming here, but no, I don't think about owing them anything.
Mm-hmm. And we don't owe them anything. And we have, Ford Motor Company was one of our chief sponsors back at the time that we did a story about the Ford Pinto. I mean, they were the chief, they were the biggest sponsor of 60 Minutes. And it became quite apparent that the Ford Motor Company was doing something that unsafe at any speed. I mean, they had a very, very vulnerable gas tank that could blow up a car. And to take them on, to the credit of the Ford Motor Company, they talked to us. They understood what we were after. It was back. It seems crazy. Lee Iacocca's name comes into my head.
That would have been Chrysler, but he was with Ford for a while, Mustang and all that.
That was it.
So you didn't back off in that case. Are you confident it will be the same going ahead? We hear a lot about consolidation. The American public, speaks up, worried that it's not getting the full story.
Look, there were three networks. There aren't just three networks anymore. There are 300. And as a result of which, you're getting a lot of infotainment. You're getting a lot of garbage on the air, a lot of tabloid. And it's the new guy at CBS News, Sean McManus, Jim McKay's son, who used to run CBS Sports, just like Lou Knowledge used to run ABC Sports and then came over to the news division and did a superb job of running that. I have every confidence that Sean McManus is going to be able to do that, and he vows that he's going to do it. It's going to take a little time. But to put the shine back on the Tiffany News Department of the Tiffany Network.
Well, we'll be watching So Will the World. You certainly had plenty of entertaining moments. There's one I loved, Mike, from the DVD with Vladimir Horowitz, another guy you really respect. I know you, the great pianist, of course, and you finally... you got him to play something he hadn't played in 30, 40 years, Stars and Stripes Forever,
yes.
A long way from his classical repertoire. Do you remember the day when you sat down with him?
Yes, I do indeed. Well, first of all, the day before, he wanted to test the acoustics and the piano and so forth. This was in Chicago, and I was in awe of him. I'm a old fiddle player. As a matter of fact, a Bostonian by the name of Harry Ellis Dixon was my
yes.
violin teacher.
Wow, that's a famous name.
At $5 a shot.
Yeah.
A lesson. In any case, come on back, Mike. He walked in and I said, "Oh, maestro. Mike Wallace, I watch you every Sunday night." So immediately the intimidation factor was gone.
Right.
On the last day of the Second World War at a victory rally in Central Park.
He had played it, 1945.
That's correct.
And you remembered that, and you had him play it on that day. Before we get out of here, we're going to hear that, Mike Wallace. We're going to turn to it as our closing little bit, a little music
perfect.
From Vladimir Horowitz. Before then, I want to ask, how much longer? 87, how much longer do you do it?
Until my toes turn up.
And you're not
and
kidding.
From time to time, they're beginning to turn up just a little.
Mike Wallace, it's been an incredible career. We're very grateful for your time today, for the book. We thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Mike Wallace, his new memoir is Between You and Me. Let's listen to Mike and Vladimir Horowitz, 1977.
Do you love this country enough, maestro, to respond to a request for you to play something that you haven't played in many, many years in public?
Yeah, but I don't know it.
You know what I'm going to ask you?
Yes, I know, because they ask me all the time.
The Stars and Stripes Forever. You played that back in 1945. On the I Am an American Day.
That's right.
Central Park.
I like this much.
Are you enough of a patriot?
No, I forgot that. I tell you, I don't know it. But I have to remember. It's so difficult.
I'm sure that it's difficult.
Go ahead. Go
at the end?
Go on from there.